Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome everyone. My second guest today is leading malpractice attorney and patient advocate Patrick Malone. And he says that medical mistakes claim more lives each year than breast cancer, AIDS, and car crashes combined. They estimate that about 40,000 incidences of medical harm occur every day in the U.S. while you're under medical care. And according to Penn University, medical malpractice tort costs in 2007 were as much as $30.4 billion. And that number is rising exponentially. So that's coming up around 12:30. We'll take a look at the shocking situations behind some of those medical malpractice suits, what you need to know, and what you need to know about getting good care and avoiding substandard care. But first, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Paul Blanc. He joins me to discuss how everyday items may be making you sick. Dr. Paul Blanc is a professor of medicine and holds the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's written a really compelling expose. It's called How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. Dr. Paul Blanc, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, this is an amazing book. First of all, I just want to re-stress here, you're an occupational and environmental medical doctor.
That's correct.
You treat diseases and injuries that people get from their work or as a result of pollution. So what are some of the issues that you might deal with?
Well, one of the common problems, for example, is asthma related to exposures on the job or sometimes in hobby vocations and sometimes related to household activities as well. And I also do work related to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease because most commonly the important route of exposure is by inhalation. Most of my work focuses on issues related to the lung. And that's also my area of research.
It was quite shocking, some of the stuff that I read in this book. And I know your idea is not to shock people, but to inform people and educate us and let us know when we might be putting ourselves in harm's way. So you work as a poison control physician. You've also been called on to cases resulting from toxic chemical exposures. And this is what alarmed me. In all of the work you do and all of the research you do, you said that many of the cases that we are seeing today, we knew about 20, 30 years ago, and they're still going on.
Well, I mean, that's even an understatement because many of them we knew about 100 years or 200 years or 2,000 years ago in example of the toxicity of lead, which was very well appreciated since antiquity.
Yeah, and you said that in all of the cases that you investigate and treat, there's a key unifying connection. It links every episode, and that's basically that men and women have fallen victim to hazards that they need not have come in touch with. Why are we still coming in touch with these hazards at work?
Well, I don't have a full explanation, but I can tell you that the phenomenon seems to be a kind of collective amnesia where a hazard is identified, the connection between exposure and disease is well delineated, and then over a period of years, people seem to forget about it, and then 20 years later or 30 years later, or 40, the same problem appears. Maybe it's a slightly different industrial application, somewhat different circumstances, but essentially the same story. Of course, part of it is because our regulatory controls tend to be ineffectual or over time are undermined. And that's a recurring theme as well.
Yeah, now this shocked me, exasperated me, frustrated me, because I thought we were getting further along in this game here. We all know about the scares we had with pet food coming from China. Then there was toothpaste and there was baby formula. And then I read this in your book, that we are still asking these companies to voluntarily self-monitor themselves. Why that? Why can't we come up with a more, and I know this is not your department per se, but in your experience, why is it that we're still asking for self-monitoring versus really...
Well, there's a very clear answer to that, and that is that many of the items that come into the home as consumer products are regulated by a federal agency called the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which most of your listeners have probably never heard of for good reason, because they're the poster child for failed regulation. Unlike the EPA or the FDA or OSHA, this group really has missed the boat, and they're the ones that brought us the million toy march of leaded playthings from China a couple of years ago. And their approach, quite openly, is that they much prefer voluntary action to any kind of binding steps on their part. And they very rarely have anything but voluntary recalls of products. For example.
Go ahead.
And the problem with the Chinese fiasco is that it went on far too long when it was clear that something was wrong. There really hasn't been enough inspection to put teeth in any kind of agreement, and the agreements that have been reached, as far as I understand them, are sort of gentlemen's agreements with the Chinese that they'll stop doing it. Of course, we also export toxic hazards to China. Believe me, it's a two-way street.
Yeah. One
of the emerging problems that people are taking a lot of note of, scientists are taking note of, is the issue of class of chemical flame retardants that contain bromine in multiple additions. And these polybrominated flame retardants are bioaccumulating in the environment and present a certain set of risks that, in fact, haven't been even fully mapped out. We're exporting a lot of junk electronics for recycling to China. It turns out these electronics equipment are heavily impregnated with some of these materials, and the highest blood levels of this group of chemicals that have been seen in humans have been in Chinese electronics recycling workers.
Yeah, I've actually seen a couple of documentaries. I think Frontline put one on. It was really quite well done, and some of the facilities that they have to recycle those computers in, they have no windows, no air control. It's just, but they want the money. They pull these people in from the fields, you know, who normally couldn't find work to.
And then I don't know if you followed the tragedy in the Ivory Coast, where a shipload of chemical waste was turned back in Europe and then sent on its way to Africa, where it unloaded its waste materials in the Ivory Coast. But in fact, the United States, from a policy point of view, has opposed stronger treaty or agreements that would control the exportation of hazardous waste.
Mm. One of the things that I think is really a big concern for people, because when, you know, grandparents and aunts and parents and uncles buy things for kids, they are looking for safe products. And we've still got a lot of products out there that are very harmful. This one just blew me away. There's a story in your book, and this happened in England. There was a 7-year-old girl who fell into a coma. And when she woke up, it turned out she'd eaten 80 beads because they tasted like marzipan. Tell us about that. They were coated in a chemical that's used to liquefy polymers, and they were readily available.
Yes, instead of one chemical, another was substituted in a child's toy, where it's beads that, when they're made wet, they stick together so you can make designs out of them. They go by various trade names, and when this chemical was substituted, it turned out that it's metabolized in the body to the party drug, gamma hydroxybutyrate.
Which is that's the date rape drug, right?
Well, it can be that, but it's also just a party drug that people get high with. And it has a very low safety threshold between being high and being in a coma. And in fact, that's what happened to these children, not just in England, but in Australia in particular was where it was first reported, and these toys were also imported to Canada and the United States.
So,
and by the way, subject again to a voluntary recall.
I'm speechless on that. I mean, I just am speechless on that. How do we ensure when we're buying products for our kids, especially, that they are safe? Is there a way we can ensure that?
Well, not absolutely, unfortunately, because even with this agreement on the removal of lead from toys, even since I wrote the updated material for this new edition of the book, it turned out that we're importing toys that are contaminated with cadmium from China. And cadmium is a different toxin than lead, but believe me, it's not something you want coated on your children's playthings.
Yeah.
I think an important general lesson is that we do have to be aware that there is no magic wall between being a consumer and being someone exposed on the job. If people were truly safe on the job, then consumers would be made safe too.
Yeah.
There are people working in these awful factories making these leaded children's toys, and they're not safe either.
Well, I want to talk about that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about occupational safety, because I spent a long time in California, working in California. And I thought OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Hazard Association, was way up there monitoring our safety. But let's talk about that when we come back.
Sure.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Dr. Paul Blanc, and his book is called How Everyday Products Make People Sick, Toxins at Home and in the Workplace. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Why are there so few women CEOs? Doug Branson joins Vicky to discuss common mistakes that women make in the workplace, how women can bust through obstacles to become as successful as they choose. We'll also talk with a woman who lost her husband and $1 million settlement. Heidi Ganahl turned it all around to create a doggy business that now has 200 franchises and is worth over $40 million. That's coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Welcome back. We're talking in this segment with Dr. Paul Blanc, and he has written a really great expose on products that make us sick in the work and at home. And he specializes in this. He is a medical doctor. He specializes in what makes us sick from the environment and from toxics at work. So I want to talk in this segment, Paul, about some of the issues that we see at work. I really believed that companies were being held accountable for keeping standards safe. And I really believed that in this day and age that it was in their best interest to do that. Apparently not, according to some of the information that I read. So share a little bit about that, if you would, please.
Well, you have to bear in mind that we've just passed through 8 years of central administration in Washington that had very little desire to keep our occupational safety and health apparatus functioning well and up to date. And of course, we built up quite a backlog. We really don't have enough people to get out to workplaces. I think that the current numbers are something like if every inspector went to every workplace sometime in 2050, we would get to the majority of them. Luckily, we just had a new appointee as head of the Occupational Safety Administration, David Michaels, who's quite an excellent figure, and the professionals in the field are extremely excited about this, and I think it's a step in the right direction. But the fact of the matter is the whole system is not geared so that the incentives drive the persons that are exposing occupational groups to take it on their own to guarantee safety. And some of our highest exposed groups are the ones for whom inspection is the hardest, and they're the most diffuse. Construction workers in particular, and agricultural workers is another example, forestry workers up in your part of the world. So there are a lot of groups that are underprotected.
Yeah, you made reference, I'm not sure if it was in your book or in an article that you'd written about an article that was written in the New York Times when they did an investigative report there. And that was really shocking. He talked about workers decapitated on assembly lines, shredded in machinery, burned beyond recognition, electrocuted, buried alive. And yet many of those companies were not prosecuted, because they had in those cases actually removed a safety function.
And this kind of scenario, of course, goes back to Victorian England, to the beginnings of mechanized workplaces. So it's an old and sad story. Coming back also to the issue of the separation between the workplace and consumers, I think many people have sort of followed from a distance this story of artificial butter-flavored microwavable popcorn. The chemical used as the artificial butter flavorant is called diacetyl, and it was clear for almost a decade that workers in factories who were exposed to this particular chemical were developing a severe and even life-threatening lung disease, and yet the material continued to be used. And to this day, OSHA has not set a new exposure limit for this particular chemical. It was thought that it was just people who were manufacturing the material that were at risk. And then a couple of years ago, a case of a consumer of microwavable popcorn with the same lung disease came to light. This was a pretty heavy-end consumer. He referred to himself as Mr. Popcorn and would love to stick his head into a freshly opened bag of just microwave popcorn several times a day, but nonetheless, he was a consumer. After that news broke, I think within about 48 hours, the manufacturers had removed the chemical from microwave popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the fiscal risk for payment to a third party injured by a product is orders of magnitude more than any cost of workers' compensation. And employees are part of the workers' compensation system, is that employees really can't sue their employer.
Right. So what is it, what do you see happening most in the workforce? Well, first of all, I guess if we feel we're in an unsafe situation at work, what should we do? What can we do?
Well, you certainly can contact the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And the other group that you can contact is the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which is actually part of the CDC, and they have a system where when requests are made, they will actually themselves go out and investigate outbreaks of disease. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important and underutilized vehicle for notification and follow-up as well. I mean, one of the the problems that we have now is that a smaller and smaller proportion of the labor force is in any kind of organized union these days. And that was historically one way in which people did have some regress for health and safety. There were periods, I think, when labor groups didn't take seriously enough health and safety issues, but over time, I think, came to appreciate how important it was to their membership.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your book and why you wrote this book. I was telling you during the break, this is it was so interesting, I couldn't put it down, and scary at the same time, but important. I think it's important.
Well, what really got me off on writing this book was that as I would do my own research on a particular problem, like the exposure of welders to welding fume and how it caused an odd disease. It was kind of like getting the flu and then would go away. And I would start to look back in the scientific literature, and I was thinking I was so smart and I'd figured out some aspect of this. And I'd say, well, you know, 40 years ago, somebody had reported this and done the experiments. And then I went back further, and 100 years ago, it had been detailed far better than I could. And so I realized that there was this rich history to each one of these topics as I would start to look into it, a rich history that was lost. And it seemed to me that if people could learn a bit more about not just the current state of affairs, but how we got here, people could put it into a better context.
Right.
And also, a lot of times when history is looked at, it's from the point of view of one specific scientific investigator or another or historical figures. And the approach I took was actually to do the history of the substance. So part one section of the book is the history of bleach. Another is the history of glue from Egyptian times to the present and
yeah.
so forth.
Yeah. Some horrifying incidences happening around the home with super glue involving children. You didn't sound a huge fan of super glue.
Well, you know, you have to ask yourself from a societal point of view, is it really so valuable to us to be able to stick our coffee mug handle back on with something that two trucks can't pull it apart, you know, without it disintegrating? Is that, what need is that really serving?
Right.
I mean, obviously, there are certain areas in which it is important to have highly potent and potentially irritating glue substances. Mm. And there are even medical applications, which are quite important. But for each of these advances, there's also risks that need to be taken into account. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not opposed to progress because it's progress. I just think we need to be cautious and make sure that the people who benefit are the same people who bear any cost of adverse effect.
Mm. What are some of the key things in households, in common everyday households, that that really concern you, that you see the most issues with?
Well, one of the most common problems that I write about is mishaps with cleaning products, and in particular, hypochlorite bleach mixing episodes. And I think people know somewhere in the back of their minds that you're not supposed to mix bleach with ammonia, but in fact nobody uses ammonia cleaning products anymore. But what they do use a lot of are household cleaning products that contain acids. All of those tile cleaners that you see on the shelf are typically one kind of acid or another. And when you mix that with bleach, either on purpose or inadvertently, you will release a little cloud of chlorine gas. And that's extremely irritating, and in the wrong circumstances can even be life-threatening. If you do a lot of it and you're in an enclosed space like a small bathroom that's not very well ventilated.
Yeah, and you said, you mentioned that you see a lot in the emergency room with breathing problems after doing something like that. What about gasoline? There was a link there to gas and Parkinson's disease.
Well, you know, here's a good example of something which individual consumer practices aren't going to do a lot for. You can't tell people to buy green gasoline.
Right. Right.
In fact, one of the great public health successes of the 20th century was getting rid of tetraethyl lead from gasoline. One of the big public health disasters of the 20th century was putting it there in the first place. And now the same company that essentially made its millions off of tetraethyl lead has come up with this bright idea of putting a manganese-based additive into gasoline. Now, manganese is a metal which is naturally occurring. It's even a necessary trace element in our diet. But too much of it, and especially if inhaled, leads to a Parkinson's-like neurological disease.
Interesting.
So, and those of us on the environmental side are not very happy about the potential prospect of small particulate manganese being spewed out of every tailpipe in the country. So far, the EPA has not permitted this. They haven't banned it. They're still reviewing it. At the same time, the United States shoved this down Canada's throat by forcing them to import the material through the free trade agreement. Canada actually banned the substance.
Oh, really?
And we took them to court.
And we force that. Well, we're right at the end of our segment, unfortunately. Lots to talk about, and this is a really great book. It's so thoroughly researched. I think there was something like 70 pages of notes at the end of this book. What would you like to leave our listeners with, Dr. Blanc?
I think just the old dictum that knowledge is power, and you need to know about these things if you're going to do something about them.
Mm-hmm. And if you're in a workplace that you think is hazardous, don't put up with it.
That's correct.
Go ahead and give those names out that we need to report.
In Washington State, there's a very good health and safety apparatus, the Washington State OSHA equivalent, and then there's the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health.
Great. And where can people find out more information about you and the book?
Well, you can go to your local neighborhood bookstore and order it. It's published by University of California Press. And, of course, it's available over the internet search engines as well.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Paul Blanc.
You're most welcome.
Appreciate it. And his book, again, is called How Household Products Can Make You Sick, Everyday Household Products. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with malpractice attorney and patient advocate Patrick Malone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
You offer infrared instead of sun.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we're talking about medical issues today, some important topics. Our first segment, we looked at how everyday products make people sick, toxins at home and in the workplace with Dr. Paul Blanc. And I'm joined now by Patrick Malone. He's a leading medical malpractice attorney and patient safety advocate based in Washington, D.C. You may have seen him on Good Morning America or The Today Show. And his new book is called The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care and Avoiding the Worst. Patrick Malone, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Vicki.
Well, I'm guessing that in your work, you see the best and the worst of all medical care. As I said before, you're a leading medical malpractice attorney, but I think it's important to let our listeners know that before that, you were a medical writer and an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. How did you make that transition?
Well, you know, I did a lot of work trying to educate the public with medical writing in the newspaper, but I got a little bit dissatisfied with, you know, today's papers is tomorrow's fish wrapper, and so, you know, it's in one ear and out the other, and I just felt like I could have more impact on individual people's lives by helping individual people. And so I went to law school, and kind of the rest is history. And I've enjoyed law quite a bit, and I've also really enjoyed the interface between law and medicine. And the reason I wrote this book was I just saw way too many tragedies that could have been prevented by simple things that people can do to protect themselves and get better medical care.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a look at some of those ways. I said at the top of the hour that you say in the book, medical mistakes claim more lives each year than breast cancer, AIDS, and car crashes combined, and that an estimated 40,000 incidences of medical harm occur every day. That's really shocking.
There are lots and lots of preventable issues that happen every day. The good news is that not only doctors can and nurses can prevent these things from happening, but patients too can play a role. And it starts with just being a better informed advocate for your own health care and learning how to ask questions.
Mm. And your whole book is really based around patient advocacy, what to look for, what to avoid. One of the first things you say is really important is to get your hands on your own medical records. I did not realize, actually, we could get our own medical records. I didn't really think about it, I guess. But how do we go about doing that? And what do we do if we're told, no, we can't have them?
Patients have a legal right in all 50 states to read their own medical records and to actually have a copy made for them at some minimal charge. So you can get it. And actually, Georgetown University Law Center has a whole website on the issue of showing people the specific statutes, if you really need them, in each state that say you have a legal right to your medical records. But it shouldn't go that far that you have to cite chapter and verse
right.
to these folks. You need to just send them a very polite written request that says, please send me a copy of my medical records. It's as simple as that. And what you'll learn from that is very interesting. You'll learn a lot about your own health care that you might not have realized. I advocate it as step one of my 9 steps because it's kind of an icebreaker for individual patients. You know, it seems very intimidating asking doctors all these questions and stuff and they use all this fancy vocabulary. Well, the way to kind of get your foot into that door, I think, is to start by just taking a look at your own records, see what the doctor has written about you, and kind of see what questions come to your mind. And so it's a good way to get started.
I was reminded of the Seinfeld episode when I saw that, and Elaine wanted to look at her records, and they blacklisted her everywhere.
yeah, fortunately, that doesn't happen in real life.
Right.
Except in a peculiar little section of Hollywood that nobody really lives in.
yeah. Step two, and of course, you go into much greater detail in the book than this, but you say talk to your doctor efficiently and effectively. Make a list, leave a list, and take a list. Tell us what you mean by that.
When you go to your primary care doctor, everybody's noticed how rushed they are and how little time they have. One of the things you can do to get effective care is to organize your own thoughts ahead of time and write them down. What is the reason I'm going today? What's the top thing that bothers me? What's the second thing that bothers me? Write that down. If I have symptoms, you know, what seems to bring them on, what seems to relieve them, and just kind of make a little checklist of things that you want to talk about with the doctor. Then the best thing to do is actually give that list to the doctor or the nurse, and it helps as kind of an organizing statement about here's what I want to talk about. So it makes things more efficient. They can look at your list. They can see what you think your symptoms are. They can read that faster than teasing all of that out of you with a lot of questions. And then they can move on from there to addressing all of your problems. Then when I say at the end to take a list home with you, that's the action plan that you and the doctor work up together. And it includes, well, what are the next steps? Do I need to take medication? Do I need to go get another test? Why do I need the test? All those sorts of things mm-hmm. should be written down in a little kind of bullet point checklist so that you'll really know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
the reason I say all this, is just that miscommunication and the right hand failing to know what the left hand is doing and the doctor failing to appreciate what's really wrong with the patient, that's the number one cause of preventable medical harm in the United States, and we can help do something about it.
Yeah, wow. It's also easy to forget those next steps by the time you've got home. You talk about teaming up with the best primary care doctor. How do we know if we've got the best primary care doctor, and how do we know if we've got a good team around us? Because everybody hires great marketing writers today. So what are we looking for beyond the hype?
Number one thing is to look for credentials. I tell people always look up if the doctor is board certified in exactly what they are treating you in, and you'd be surprised how many non-board certified doctors there are out there.
Really?
Board certification means that you've taken a full day test and that you've passed the test. If it's a surgery thing, you often have to take a second day oral test. But for one notorious example, this so-called cardiologist who was the live-in doctor for Michael Jackson last summer, he was not board certified in anything. And that would have been easily discoverable to anybody doing due diligence for Michael Jackson. The second thing after credentials is how good of a listener is the doctor. If you feel like you're not getting through to the doctor, if you feel like the doctor's condescending to you, you always feel stupid when you ask questions of that doctor, that's a signal that you need to think about going to another doctor, because what people don't realize is that the medical history, that the things that we carry around in our heads, that we know, the symptoms and stuff, that is the most important part of the medical examination. And for the doctor to get that history out of you accurately is the best way to reach a correct diagnosis, far more important than any of the fancy tests that can be given. They say in medicine, it's still true today as it was 100 years ago when Sir William Osler first said this, 90% of the diagnosis can be figured out from the patient's story.
Mm-hmm. Here's what I don't understand as a layman, Patrick. How can somebody call themselves a doctor if they're not board certified?
Because what people don't realize is that doctors go through a two-stage process of getting trained. First, they go to medical school. That gives them the MD degree, and that gives them a license to practice medicine in a particular state. But then to specialize in anything, or even internal medicine, or even family practice, you really should go on and get what they call residency training. And then at the end of your residency training, you take one of these board tests, which are optional. And they're run by a private foundation for each of the different boards. And you don't have to take that as a doctor, but good doctors take the test, and they're proud of having that credential.
Mm. Well, 106,000 patients I read in the American Medical Association, the journal of, 106,000 patients die each year from the negative effects of medication. 7,000 deaths per year are attributed to medication errors in hospitals. Quite staggering. And step 4 of your 9 steps is learn the safe, sensible, and skeptical approach. to using medicines. So how do we, again, cut through all of that hype, and how do we know if we're using them effectively?
You know, one thing is counterintuitive in medicine. We always think that, you know, the latest generation of the iPhone or whatever has got to be better than the prior generation. So we think if a new medication has come along, hey, we ought to try that. What people don't realize is that the first, really, 5, 6, 7 years that a new drug is on the market is really just a continuation of the experimental stage to figure out who this medicine is good for and who sometimes it can be a complete disaster for. So do you want to be a guinea pig, or do you want to wait and rely more on the kind of tried and true medicines that are already out there? The other problem that patients don't realize is that doctors are subject to constant propaganda from drug companies that come in with something as innocuous as a, you know, pencil, pen, scratch pads, or, you know, free lunch, free dinners, all sorts of things that get doctors to try their products. Really, top doctors don't even give free samples to patients because that tilts the scale of figuring out risks and benefits towards more untested medicines, because they only give you free samples for the brand new stuff.
Right. Well, you know, for listeners who are concerned about medicines that they're taking, we devoted a whole hour of that last year, and I'm pulling a Sarah Palin here because I wrote my guest's name on my hand. We talked with Melody Peterson, who's a former journalist for the New York Times, and she specializes in pharmaceutical companies and how that's all marketed. So if you go to conversationslive.net and type in Melody Peterson and or big pharmaceutical companies, that show will pop right up, and there's a whole hour devoted to that subject there. Great advice, Patrick. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about tests, because you say we need to understand that every test we have is flawed. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Patrick Malone. His book, The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care and Avoiding the Worst. Please stay with us.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. My guest in this segment is Patrick Malone. His book is called The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care and Avoiding the Worst. And Patrick is a leading malpractice attorney, medical malpractice attorney, and patient advocate. And he's written this great book full of really awesome information. In fact, I have my brother-in-law is facing major surgery very soon. He's quite poorly. And there are some things in here that I certainly would like to pass on to my sister if she can handle it right now. Patrick, I want to ask you about this. Step number 5, you say, understand why all medical tests are flawed. Seek a second or third opinion. It doesn't sound very encouraging to say that they're nearly all flawed, but in page 87 of your book, you talk about mammograms, and you give an example of how many mammograms record false positives, which totally distorts the statistics that we hear. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about tests in general and maybe mammograms in particular.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize is that every single test there is out there has got a false alarm rate to it, and also has a failure of the alarm to even go off when it should to it. There are two possible problems with each test. Either the alarm goes off when it's not supposed to, or it doesn't go off when it should go off. And that error rate, especially in a population of people who have very low incidence of whatever disease is being tested for, can really cause a huge variation in the number of people who are tested who turn out to really have the disease. Kind of hard to explain on the radio, but
yeah.
Basically on that particular, to cut to the chase on mammograms, women in their 40s, you can test 1,000 women with mammograms every year for 10 years, and because the rate of actual breast cancer in that group is so low, at the end of that time, the 10 years of testing, everybody gets one mammogram every year for 10 years. At the end of all that, in a group of 1,000 women, you'll have 70 women who test positive for cancer who don't have cancer because it's a false alarm.
Right.
And you'll have possibly 7 who have a true positive, which means that they may have breast cancer or they may have a early variation of it. So that can be worthwhile for some people to get that testing. But what I'm trying to get people to understand is don't go off the deep end if you get a test, a screening test like that, and it comes back positive. It doesn't necessarily mean you have the disease. It actually could turn out to be much more likely that you have a false alarm. So that's why I tell people always get a second test, a second opinion to sort out these false alarm issues.
Yeah, it's quite shocking. Number 6 is learn the checklist for safe surgery. And I remember a long time ago, a guest said to me, you have to remember that the doctor you go to is what kind of doctor they are is going to drive the treatment. So if you go to a surgeon, of course, they're probably going to want to operate. That's what they do. Surgeons cut.
Well, it just depends. I have a saying in the book that to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and that's
right,
exactly exactly what you're saying. However, the good thing is that a really top surgeon will be very busy, and that surgeon will be less likely to want to cut on you because they don't necessarily need the business. Now, this is one of the things with healthcare reform that people in Washington have finally recognized. We've got to reform the way we pay doctors and not just pay for quantity of medicine produced, quantity of surgery, but pay for quality and pay for results. But it's still a long way off to figure out exactly how to do that. And in the meantime, what I think people need to do is, first off, if somebody says you need surgery, you need to find out how much of this kind of exact surgery do you do every week. If they say, well, I haven't done one of these in 3 years, but trust me, I'm perfectly capable of doing it, I think you really need a second opinion from somebody who says, yes, I just did 2 of these yesterday and 3 the day before that. So somebody who is regularly doing this kind of work because practice makes perfect,
mm-hmm.
and they have found that volume really does matter in surgical quality, and it can also matter in the doctor's perspective of whether you really need that surgery in the first place.
And going back to the Journal of American Medical Association article that I referred to earlier, and this was from 2008. I couldn't find a newer one, but they said there that 12,000 deaths result as a result of unnecessary surgery. 80,000 people die due to complications from infections and, you know, other complications. So
it's a real issue. You know, a lot of people get scared into surgery. And they kind of panic, and they need to kind of step back. And if this isn't, one question to ask is, if I don't have this today, will something terrible happen to me? And if they say, well, no, nothing bad will happen to you today, that gives you enough of a chance to get a second opinion. And that's what you need to do. And you always need to ask the question, if I don't have this surgery at all, let's say not just today, but next week or even next month or next year, what's the worst that could happen to me? And then you start to probe into what those answers are. It could turn out that, hey, this is totally optional whether or not you should have this surgery. I have a client right now who has this exact situation. He had a blockage of an artery in his shoulder going down one arm, but the arm was perfectly functional, no problems at all.
Wow.
A surgeon talked him into surgery, and he wound up with permanent nerve damage that destroyed his ability to use his hand. And he had total ability to use both hands beforehand. So that's a huge unnecessary injury that happened because he didn't get the full explanation of what the benefit was of having the surgery and what the true risk was.
Right. We're coming up to the end of this segment here, so I just want to make sure I get these in. Step number 7 is have an advocate with you every step of the way. We've talked about that quite a bit on the show, but what if somebody doesn't have a family member or friend who can be their patient advocate?
Well, I guess there are, you know, some single folks out there who don't have anybody, but I really urge people as strongly as possible to try to recruit a helper just to go with you for a doctor visit or whatever, like your sister and your brother-in-law is a perfect example, because what people don't realize they need someone to act as their brains when you, the patient, are feeling so sick that you're not in a position to make logical decisions and to listen carefully and understand stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There is starting to be a movement of professional patient advocates that you can hire, but it's still a little pricey, and the best thing to do is try to recruit a family member to help you.
Mm-hmm. Step 8 is steer clear of major hazards of hospitals, and step 9, if you develop a chronic disease, educate yourself in what you need to do, audit your care, make sure you get through it. This is all really detailed in the book. What's the one thing you'd like people to know about if they have lost somebody? Where do they begin to piece things together very quickly? We're almost at the end of our segment.
If something really terrible happens, despite following my advice, I've got a whole chapter on how you can ask probing questions of the care providers to find out exactly what it was that happened. You can go over their heads. You can ask questions of the hospital administrator. There are agencies that you can ask to do investigations. There's a good list of all these near the end of my book. And I have a chapter on the web excerpted from the book. The chapter is on my book website, which is called lifeyousave.com. One word, lifeyousave.com. And there's a lot of good stuff on there, so I'd urge your listeners to check that out.
Yeah, this is a really great book and very readable and has some really terrific information in here. What's the last thing you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Patrick?
Well, I'd like people to realize that the culture of medicine can be intimidating. There's a lot of hierarchy out there, a lot of paternalism, but what people really need to know is that the best care you're going to get is from people who don't follow the old-fashioned hierarchy and treat you, the patient, as a respected member of the medical team, somebody who's a full partner in the care, somebody who deserves full information, and to be treated like an adult. That's how you get the best medical care, and you can find good doctors and nurses and hospitals who will treat you that way.
Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing such great information. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Vicki.
My guest again, Patrick Malone. His book, The Life You Save, 9 Steps to Finding the Best Medical Care and Avoiding the Worst. And you can find out more at his website, which was
LifeYouSave.com.
LifeYouSave.com. Thank you for being with us today. If you have any questions or feedback on today's show, you know where you can find me. I'll give you the number. It's 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can drop me an email at Vicki@conversationslive.net. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, why are there so few women CEOs? Doug Branson joins Vicki to discuss common mistakes that women make in the workplace and how women can bust through obstacles to become as successful as they choose. We'll also talk with a woman who lost her husband and a $1 million settlement. Heidi Ganahl turned it all around to create a doggy business that now has 200 franchises and is worth over $40 million. That's coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for more information.